People of the Earth, welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio. Thank you for listening. I hope you're doing wonderful wherever you are in the world. I had last week off because it was my wife and I's third anniversary of when we got married. I was in Florida visiting my family, saw some friends that mean a great deal to me, and we took a few days off and stayed at the Postcard Inn on St. Petersburg Beach. If you think everything in Florida sucks, which a lot of people do, and I think they're about 85-86% right, check out the Postcard Inn on St. Pete Beach. It's a wonderful spot. It's an old, funky hotel that's been renovated. The rooms that are right alongside the pool have your own personal hammock in front of it. That's where we stayed. But my favorite thing about this hotel is it's on a magnificent stretch of St. Pete Beach. The sand is gorgeous, the sunsets are magnificent, and even though I got a little sunburned, it's a great place to do absolutely nothing. It was a celebratory week because it was our anniversary, but it was also a week of upgrades. My computer pooped out on me recently, and I got a brand new turbo computer, and my microphone for the podcast also took a poop. So this is the fourth microphone that I've used for this podcast, and it's the most expensive badass one I've got. And I think the sound quality and everything's going to be a lot better. My wife is studying and mastering a new software to edit the podcast, and I can hear all my listeners all over the world collectively say, hooray! And I thank you for your patience on some of the shabby quality on the sound that you've experienced. But anyway, life keeps getting better, and the podcast keeps getting better. It's, you know, it's a work of art in progress. So I want to start out today by giving a few shout-outs to some Rhodesies that sent me some very nice emails in the past week. Number one, Joe in San Diego. Joe said he used to see me perform at the Improv on Pacific Beach. That's in the San Diego area. PB Beach, as the hipsters down there call it. Man, that used to be one of the best clubs in the world. That was the only place I've ever performed that there was a girl one time, a very hot surfer chick, sat in the front row with a skirt on and no panties. And I only looked down several times because I was very focused on the comedy. But that place was so cool. Eddie Vedder met his first wife. She was a waitress there. And I didn't know who he was, but Eddie Vedder used to hang out in the back. It was before Pearl Jam popped. That's one significant thing about that place. It's where I met my current manager. He was the manager of that club, and he's gone on to manage some big comedians in the world today. But Joe lost track of me after I moved to Europe, and he was pleasantly surprised to find out that I'm still alive and still doing stand-up comedy. And he recently discovered my podcast, and he's been catching up, and he's been loving it, and he wrote me a really nice message telling me to keep kicking ass in the comedy world and keep making the podcast, please. And hey, thanks for threatening to drive your happy ass all the way to Los Angeles if I don't schedule a show in San Diego anytime soon. Thanks, Joe. Really appreciate that. I also want to give a shout out to Laura in Los Angeles. Laura said she's seen me perform at the Hollywood Improv several times. She listens to the podcast, and she was concerned about me because I stopped drinking this year. And she was worried that my serotonin levels were down and that I might be a cranky bastard sometimes. People she loves in her life had quit drinking, and they tried to overcompensate with coffee, and it made them kind of moody and depressed and cranky, and she was just concerned about my well-being and wanted me to be aware of that, and that my serotonin levels would be down, and that I should try and do something healthy like exercise to raise my serotonin levels. So, hey, Laura, I hope you're listening. My sister's name was Laura. I love you already, but the fact that you sent me this really heartfelt message really touches my heart that people love me that much to be that concerned about my serotonin levels. Thanks, Laura. I appreciate that message. I flew to Los Angeles yesterday, and I was changing planes in Los Angeles when the NBA commissioner, Adam Silvers, I think that's his name, gave Donald Sterling his lifelong ban from basketball. And it was really interesting because I had a few hours between my flight, before my flight to Los Angeles, and I was surrounded by some older black women who had probably seen a lot of racism in their life. And it was really interesting when the NBA commissioner gave this lifelong ban to Donald Sterling, and me and these older black women all clapped. It was a very beautiful moment, and I was happy to be a part of it. There's so much to say about that Donald Sterling incident. Racism is an ugly thing. It's a deal breaker. Sure, you should be able to say whatever you want in your own home because we don't want to live like people do in North Korea or George Orwell's 1984 with speakers in people's houses and no privacy. But, you know, racism's kind of a deal breaker, and what a schmuck saying that he didn't want black people to come see basketball games. You know, in my opinion, Donald Sterling should have been kicked out of the NBA years ago for the fact that the Clippers sucked for over 30 years and he had the lowest payroll and never put any money into the team. Forget racism. Forget the fact that the guy's a rich idiot. Forget the fact that he was cheating on his wife. I think that guy should have been kicked out of the NBA just for disappointing his fans and the fact that he never put any money into the team and the fact that they stunk year after year after year. And what the hell is a Clipper? I think that was supposed to be like a Yankee Clipper, the ship. Anyway, he's gone. He's banned for life. And, you know, he was a Los Angeles person who was kind of a negative, bitter turd. And today's guest is the complete opposite of that. My guest today is Maz Jobrani, an absolute big, bright ball of sunshine in the world of comedy, and he lives in Los Angeles. I recorded this episode in his home a few months ago when I was here, and got to meet his beautiful wife, his amazing kids that are just, you know, so happy and wonderful. I gotta say, Maz Jobrani, I am a fan of this guy because whenever I'm in Los Angeles, I always see him out at the clubs. He's got a certain level of success, you know. He was one of the founding members of the Access of Evil tour, comedy tour. He's been in a lot of films. He recently met the president. The guy's got a nice, loving family home, a great house. The guy is always out there, always working on new material. And I have to say, I'm a fan of his comedy because it contains the original energy and spirit of joy. And that's what comedy's all about. That's what life is all about. That's what it's all about. Whatever you're doing in life, try and be happy. Enjoy what you're doing. Have fun. Don't be a negative, bitter turd. There are enough negative, bitter turds on the planet. And I love Maz Jobrani, and it's my pleasure to present to you now a happy, joyous example of how a human being should be in life. Here he is, the one and only Maz Jobrani. Maz Jobrani, ladies and gentlemen.
Tom Rhodes, hey, how are you?
I'm researching you last couple days, and you met President Obama and Michelle.
Yes, I did. So, first of all, thank you for doing research. I didn't know anyone in the podcast world does research.
Is that your experience?
I mean,
you go somewhere and they're like, so, you're Mexican, right?
Yeah. Well, you know what is funny, actually? I actually appreciate, like, we got to do a lot of radio. And one of my...
My least favorite thing about being a comedian?
Absolutely. But one of my most favorite is when you show up and the guy has actually done research. Usually they have a producer or somebody.
It's so flattering because it so rarely happens.
Right, and you're like, wow, you actually care about this.
Yeah.
Whereas you show up, exactly what you just said, people would be like, I've had interviews where they go, all right, so tell us about yourself. You know, you're Iranian? You know? They'd be like, you do your stuff in English, or what do you do? And like, have you even just clicked? If you just Google and watch one clip,
that's funny. Tell us about yourself, and what can we expect from your show? Total non-committal. I've done no research whatsoever.
Yeah. And you gotta be like, well, they expect some laughs. I think they're hoping that you tell a joke at that point, which is never a good idea. in radio like to do your stand-up because it just doesn't translate that well.
Right, and then you've got the sidekick who like just perfectly jumps in on the sweet spot, the pause right before the punchline.
Oh, forget
it. There's an art to like wrecking a comedian's joke.
There really is.
And you know what? These guys are great at it.
It's funny what you just said about jumping on the punchline. I realized this when I did one episode of Chelsea and it went like, eh. And then I didn't go back. And I think part of that was I realized when you're amongst other comedians in those settings where it's a panel, you don't have time to do the pause for your punchline.
You got
to
jump in.
Because as soon as you do the pause for your punchline, they're on it. You're like, dude, he just ruined my punchline.
Right, right, right.
You know?
With a less funny thought.
With a less funny thought. Yeah.
So why didn't it just went okay? Because you weren't like getting in the dogfight?
I think I just kind of, first of all, I don't like making fun of people that much. So if you give me even celebrities.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes on stage, if I'm, you know, bothered by a celebrity, I could go
I've
off.
I've never seen you be mean.
I'm not that mean.
You know, your humor's not mean, and the thing that I like the most about you is you can really see you have joy in performing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you can see a comedian who, like, actually is loving and happy being on stage, it's like, it's a world of difference.
Yeah, and I mean, that's who I am. I've always been a nice guy. Like, I think high school I got, like, nicest guy. Right? I've always been nice. I don't think I've ever been a jerk about anything. So I think, and I tell young comedians, I go, part of your journey is to become closer off stage to who you are on stage. I think that, you know, because for me then eventually what happened was after several years of doing this at some point, I don't even know when it was, maybe the 10-year mark or something, I started realizing I was writing off stage because my thoughts were what they're going to be on stage. And then just on stage, I'd have to just go and punch it up. But whatever was happening to me was what I'd bring. So I think your personality basically eventually, if it comes together, then you're getting further to your truth. And I think part of, I always say stand-up is kind of like therapy. I think you're getting further and further into who you are. So maybe that's why on stage you were saying like I seem like a nice guy, because in general I think I'm a nice guy. I don't find a reason in life to be a prick to anybody, you know. That said, I do get upset about certain things, and it's fun to get upset and yell and rant and rave sometimes, you know. But the Obama thing, real quick, just to go back to it.
Oh, wait a minute. I loved where you were going right there. Go ahead.
Yeah. I filed it in my head.
Get in there.
Yeah. Well, the Obama thing is interesting because what happened was at some point, I think when we did the Access to Evil comedy tour, I think we kind of fell on the radar of some of the DC folks, and I don't know how high up in the administration, but people that were working maybe in DC knew us. We'd go to D.C. We'd do
shows. So you were part of bettering relations with Tehran.
Basically. I brought peace to Iran.
He's Iranian. Maybe he's related to somebody.
Yeah. Bring him in. Maybe he's got an uncle or something. But no, so it was... So we then started getting... Like every year we would get... I would get... I think probably all the Access to Evil guys would get these invites to the iftar dinner at the White House, which is when they break the fast of Ramadan, right? At the end of Ramadan, they have a big dinner to celebrate. And usually it would say, like, you know, this will be attended by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Da, da, da. They weren't paying you. It wasn't performing. It was just you're invited to come.
Do you get, like, a list of, like, protocol and etiquette?
Nothing like that. It was just an email.
Don't wear shorts and flip-flops.
No shorts, you know.
Start with the salad fork.
Yeah, bring the turban.
Just for the photo shoot.
And it was actually interesting. I think we started getting it when it was under Bush. So Condoleezza Rice was going to be... It was always the second
state. Oh, really?
Okay.
Yeah. Because I was going to ask you a smart-ass question of did Obama being president and Bush going away hurt your career at all?
Well, yeah. And I'll get to that. It's funny. So let me tell you the Obama story, then I'll get to that as well.
That must have been the salad days.
I think every comedian felt like, because with Bush, you didn't have to write a joke. You just report on what he did that day. And it was hilarious.
Yeah.
And then Obama suddenly, I've tried to write jokes about him, but just nothing has come across funny. And what's interesting for me is he was probably, there was a few jokes that I could hit on during Bush and the Iraq war and everything. But thankfully, whenever you do any kind of topical material anyway, that stuff gets dated no matter what.
Right. Even it's like a shelf life of like a month or two.
Yeah, even the name Axis of Evil became dated towards the end of Bush and as soon as Obama came in. So that was one of the reasons where I said, hey, you know, this name doesn't even work anymore, you know, so it's like, let's just move on.
And but an absolute brilliant concept when at its inception.
Oh, yeah, when it hit.
You guys had a great run with that.
Oh, my God. Well, what was great was it was interesting because a few people, because originally what happened was Mitzi Shore.
I almost thought about converting to Islam. Just
you should have
part of
it. You would have been in. You just got to get an ID and you're in. Mitzi Shore put us together originally around the year 2000, before September 11th. She said, she goes, I think there's going to be a need for a positive voice for middle, people from that part of the world. Because she was watching the news.
Well, that was foresight.
A lot of foresight. Yeah. And then the next year, September 11th happened, but we had started a tour under Arabian Nights with me, Ahmed Ahmed, and Aaron Cater, and sometimes Sam Tripoli as well. And then eventually I think we got to a point where Iranians aren't Arabs, so the name Arabian Nights just didn't fit. We'd have audience members coming up after the show going like, you know, I enjoyed the show, but we're not Arabs. The Iranians would say, I mean, all right, chill, don't worry about it, we'll figure something out. So eventually somebody threw out that name, Axis of Evil. We thought this was a great name. And one of the people at one point has said, what if people, this might rub people the wrong way. And I said, listen, the people that get it will get it. The people that don't like us won't like us, even if we name the tour, you know, the George Bush is an awesome man tour. They don't care. As soon as they see who we are, they're not going to want to see us. So that came together well, and like I said, it got us these invites to iftar dinner every year. And I never went to these dinners because part of me was like, look, it's going to be 700 people at the dinner with the Secretary of State, and it's going to be like literally, you know, 1 second of maybe a quick picture and you're done. I was like, I got to fly out there, put myself up. I got a busy schedule, and it's like, and I was like, I'm not into it. So then with that mentality, a few years ago, I get an invite from the White House that says Christmas party. And at first, I thought it was like, you know, they're looking for donations. I didn't know what it was. And I actually had a gig that night in Toronto. And so initially, I was like, whatever. Like, I'm not going to go. Because again, I was like, it's going to be the same thing. And, you know, 1,000 people. You know, I'm in the one side of the room. Obama's on the other side. I've canceled my gig to go to this. And I feel like a jerk. So I told my wife, I was like, yeah, we got this invite. You know, I'm not even going to go. And then I told my agent. My agent's like, are you crazy? You got to figure this out. So I called the Toronto guy. I'm like, listen, can we reschedule? He's like, sure. So I flew myself out and with my wife, and it was great because at the time we had our kids, and when you got young kids, like, you getting away is great. Like, it's like a reliving a honeymoon. So it was great. It was the best. I mean, you wanna get some action? Take your wife to the White House.
Flawless.
Oh my God, it was great. So what was cool about it was I still didn't know why I got invited. I had no idea. And then I show up. And there's a line of people lined up to go past one security guard where you show your ID. And as I'm in that line, I see another one of the Axis of Evil comics, Dino Bidala, who'd been invited as well. We start talking, and I go, how'd you end up getting here? He goes, I got this invite, this and that. And then it wasn't till we went, there's like two or three lines of security. So by the time we got to like the second line, we showed our IDs, my wife showed her ID, and then they go, oh, does it match the name that we have? Like somehow the spelling was off. They go, listen, you just got to go back to this other security check. They'll fix it and you can come back. So while we're at the other security check, they were super nice. There's a lady who's like a White House representative or something. And she's like, okay, if you folks just don't mind, just stand over here. We're going to fix this right away. And there's like a few other people hanging out. And I go, listen, maybe you know. I go, I'm just curious how I got invited to this. Like, how did I end up on this? Like, how did I get on this list? And right next to her was this guy, who was standing right next to her, who almost looked like a younger Obama. What's his last name right now? Paul Montero. And he works at the White House. And he goes, actually, I invited you. And I was like, oh, what's the deal? He goes, well, you know, this is a... Because the Obamas, I guess, were doing a series of Christmas parties with a lot of people. But they were inviting different people that they felt were influencers within their communities. So this night, they had some Middle Eastern people. They had some other, you know, with professors, there was businessmen, all kinds of people mixing together. And the idea was, you know, you get to go, you're at this dinner, you're at the White House, which is really cool. And Paul was saying, this guy Paul said that he found me because one of his interns was a young Iranian girl who they were like, who's influential in the Middle Eastern community? She goes, have you seen this guy? He saw the comedy, invited me. And it was pretty cool, man. So basically what it is, they give you a number, and that indicates what time you got to go down and line up for your picture with the president.
Yeah.
And so we're mixing and mingling. We're taking pictures with all the paintings. There's all these paintings of presidents around So we're taking pictures, we're eating the food, we're having a good time, we're mixing and mingling. It's a party at the White House. It's pretty cool. And then eventually you go stand in line, and then they basically guide you through the thing. And it's so funny because my wife was like, she's like, okay, you know, you get one shot. They get you right there, and they take a picture, you're done.
Don't blink.
Don't blink. And so we go, and then, and it's none of this like, oh, hey, can I take one with my iPhone? You don't want to do that, you know what I'm saying? Because they have a professional guy set up. So we come around, and then we're next in line, and there's like a Marine who will introduce you. They'll be like, you know, Maz Jobrani, Preetha, you know, Jobrani, this is President Obama and Michelle Obama. So we do the handshakes and whatever. Hi, nice to see you, whatever. And my mom had, everyone, once everyone knew I was going to go to this, everyone had a message. My, you know, conservative friends were
to
like,
give to Obama.
Conservative friends.
You give him a bunch of envelopes.
Right.
This is from my aunt. Yeah. This is from my cousin.
Yeah, my stockbroker wants you not to raise it to, you know. It was funny. So the only one that I gave was my mom. So my mom said, tell him I love him. You know, so of course I get over there and I go, hey, by the way, my mom loves you. So, oh, thank you. Tell her I love her too. And then we take the picture and then we walk away. And as we're walking away, my wife's like, oh my God. She's like, I think I looked the other way. Or I think I messed up. I was like, what do you mean? She goes, he grabbed me. I go, what do you mean?
What?
She goes, he grabbed my side, pulled me in tight. I was like, what? Yeah. Like, he did what to you? And the whole time I was nervous. I was like, this picture's going to come back and she's going to be like looking up. And just, you know. But it came back and it was great and it's an awesome picture and I'm proud of that, man. It's a cool, I mean, you know, that was it. It was 2 seconds. That was all, that's all we had. But ever since then, they've had like a couple of like, you know, meetings of Iranians and what you want to do, like what the administration can do. And like they've reached out and invite me to those. So it's been kind of cool, man. I mean, I'm not as involved as, you know, I could be. Because you know how it is, man. You're just busy. You got your work. You got
to write gigs. You got to write jokes.
You got to write jokes.
Make go to the gigs.
Yeah, yeah. I can't show up at the White House with ideas. Yeah. You know, I got jokes. So yeah, man. That was the meeting Obama, man.
Cool. Well, the thing I saw, it said that you were an ambassador of mixed race couples.
Who said that?
I thought I saw that, something like
you
that.
You know what, dude? I'll tell you what happened.
And so I was like, is that how he got invited?
No, Tom, I tell you, what's crazy is there's so many people out there now on the internet, and they have so much, and they interpret so much.
Okay.
And I think what happened was I probably put that picture up, and there's all these, like, within the Persian community, Sam Tripoli actually labeled me. He goes, you're like the Persian Elvis, otherwise known as Pelvis. And what's funny is I think there's so many different, like, you know, online magazines, and there's this and there's that, and they'll take your picture and they'll post it themselves with some sort of title or something. And I think somebody there might have been like,
right,
you know what it was? It might have been, there was a guy, I think this was it, there's a website where the guy wanted to do an interview with me about marrying outside of Iranians. And I was kind of giving him I was like, hey man, it's all okay. Good, you know? And I think that's what it was. I bet you he put it up as like, he's the ambassador.
Yeah, that was kind of the title under the photo that I saw.
That's what it is.
And I was like, okay,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So your wife is of Indian descent.
Yeah, she's Indian.
And my wife is of Indian descent.
Yes, yes.
So what advice can you give me about being in a mixed race couple so that I can exploit my wife for comedy material?
Beautiful. Well, right off the bat, you can play with all of the Indian stereotypes are very, very wide open for people to love them.
Yeah, you just got to do that 7-Eleven voice. And it
yeah,
kills.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's so funny because I actually, when I first met her, we were at a dinner. My friend had brought her, and she's a beautiful Indian woman. She walks up, and I start talking to her. We're hitting it off, and then I just jokingly, I was kind of drunk, I was at a club, and jokingly I go, so are you Indian, like, woo, or Indian, like, and I quoted my forehead. And then she...
So like the worst thing you could say to me.
Horrible, horrible. And then, so she turns to my friend, she goes, yeah, I'm Indian, woo, which she's not, but she's messing with me. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And I go back to eating. And then she turns to my friend, and she's like, what a moron. And then my friend's like, dude, she just called you a moron. And that was like, that was it. I was in. And I told her, I said, you know, and Jerry Maguire, he goes, you had me at hello. I always tell her, I go, you had me at moron. You know? And then after that, it's funny because you know how it is, man. I mean, you get material from real life. And I, you know, I used to do this joke about how, like, I would say, like, yeah, I'm married an Indian woman. And I was like, not Indian, like, ooh, but Indian, because I actually said that in my real life with it. But then I go, you know, I go something, something, and I go, yeah, that's right, I married tech support. And then the people would laugh, and then I would joke about it a little bit, and then I go, no, but the truth is my wife is actually the least tech savvy Indian in the world. And I go, that's right, I got a defective Indian. Now,
oh,
but here's what's funny. She's really bad, and it's all truth. Like, she is horrible. I mean, so many times after I did that joke, we've had moments where she'll be like, how does this phone turn off? And I'm like, thanks. I go, tech support. I go, so I'm like the tech support. But it's funny because then the joke I did about myself was, you know, like Iranians tend to be good businessmen and they haggle and all that stuff. And I'm not the best at that. Like whenever I get into haggling, I always start feeling bad for the person I'm negotiating with, especially if it's in like a third world country, you know, like where they're trying to sell you. One time I was in Morocco and the guy was like, American, American, you know, you want chess? You want chessboard? They go, no, I'm okay, man. It's like $20 chessboard. I'm like, no, I really don't want a chessboard. It's like $10. Give me $10. I'm like, no, I really. He's like, $1. I'm like, how cheap is this chessboard?
Yeah.
Like, what the
hell? Well, it kills me like when you're like some third world country in Asia or something, they'll start out the bidding at like 20 and then they go down to 10 and then they go to $1. And I always go, why don't you just give it to me?
Yeah. At this point. So true. And yet with all that said, it's funny because like I said, I mean, like my people are known to be business people and like they'll negotiate you and they bring you down. And some of it is probably because I grew up in America and I'm not as easy with that. Like my aunt came to visit me one time. I was living in Italy, junior year abroad, and my aunt came to Italy and she's very good at negotiating. She never takes the first price. We went into these stores in Italy that are like boutiques.
Like regular, where the price is the price.
High end, in a sense. It says fixed, prices are fixed. Like dresses are like $10,000 each. And she'd just go in there and lowball the hell out of it. She'd be like, I'll give you $1,000. And these Italians, no, madam, no. And she'd be like, and then one time she goes, okay, good, yes. She acted like she didn't understand. She goes, yes, okay, I'm going to go, I'll be back. And she came back and the guy was so frustrated. I forget what it was, but the guy gave her the discount because she was so pushy.
It worked.
And then the opposite of that is me in Morocco with my wife. And at the time we're dating and we have this like tour guide. You're not supposed to get these tour guides, but we got one. And he took us into a rug store. I wasn't even looking for a rug.
Yeah.
At the time, really, I was living at my mom's house in a one little bedroom. And I had nowhere to put a rug. Was not looking for a rug. And we sit down, and they start bringing us mint tea. And the guy, and the way they sell it, they go, I go, oh, yeah, this is cool, but I don't need to look at it. And he's like, no, it's just for look, just for look.
Exactly.
And you're like, well, I got all afternoon free. I can just for look, you know.
Right. Next thing you know, you bought four of them.
Dude, they first start with 10. I'm not kidding. He goes, which 10? I give you a deal for 10. I'm like, no, I got nowhere to put it.
Just here for the tea.
Yeah, what am I, open up a dealership? And then at the end, finally he's like, okay, buy three. You just buy three. And then I felt guilty. And then I spent $1,200 on rugs.
Wow.
And I didn't have, first of all, this is where it got even freakier because we didn't, first I go, look, I don't have cash. I go, all I got is credit cards. So I'm like, oh, that'll get me out of this. And the guy's like, no, I have a machine. He goes and gets one of those chick, you know, the old.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh God. And then I go, well, how am I going to carry? He goes, we ship. I'm like, oh my God. So I go, okay, ship it, blah, blah, blah. So buy it. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I go, I don't even know. Did we buy it? Are they going to send it or not? And I'm like, you know what? They'll send it. Then we go into, this was in Fez. Then we go to Marrakesh. We run into this couple, a little bit older, a little more experienced. And we start talking and they're Irish. And I was like, this, that, I bought these rugs. And the guy is the nicest guy. And like in the middle of my conversation, he looks at us and he's like, oh no, Maz, he's like, I'm sorry. I'm like, what? He's like, those rugs aren't coming. I'm like, what? He's like, oh yeah, it's a scam. It's like, they do this all the time. I'm like, no. So now I'm in Marrakesh on a payphone calling my credit card company going like, I want to cancel this. They're like, well, did they not send it? I go, no, I think they're not going to send it. They go, well, until they don't send it, we can't just negate it.
Right.
So it was this thing. And then thank God, I was so happy. Once I got here, at least the rugs were here.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is this one of the rugs in this
room? No, it's not.
Because you got a lot of nice rugs in your house.
Thank you. Well, this is
like,
let me tell you, what's here?
You're all stressed out. Your house looks great because of these great rugs.
Let me tell you, Tom, here's the crazy part is I'm Iranian, so we have a culture of rugs. So it's like,
well, we went to Turkey in last September, and
yeah.
Everywhere you go, people are trying to sell you rugs.
That's it. And Persian rugs.
And then it's like
rugs.
100 degrees. I'm going to walk around with a big rug.
I know, but that's what they got to make their money. And here's the problem with buying a rug. It's like, there's a lot of things in life where I have no idea what the value is.
Right.
Like you need to have a rug expert with you to go, oh yeah, this is the real, oh yeah, this is.
Right, the thread count's pretty bad.
How do I know? You could tell me this rug right here that we're on is 50,000 or 50.
Yeah.
I have no idea. And yet it's like I ran into this recently with the plumber. We had plumbing problems. I have no idea. The guy shows up. He's like, oh, man, this is deep. But what's going to be $5,000? I'm like,
you
got
to trust him. Yeah.
I got to trust him. You need to have a friend that's an expert in everything to be able to call the plumber. Hey, man, he wants to do this, this, and that. Is it right? what I'm saying? That doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do the research online, but how much research can I do and figure it out?
Right.
So I'm constantly in those, like, in that quagmire where I'm trying to figure
especially
out.
Especially a house. We'd be terrified. We have no idea how much stuff costs. You're like, what? We need a new roof? Okay.
Dude, we bought our...
When we were in Turkey, some of the prayer carpets were just stunningly beautiful. I was like, I was tempted, and I was like, I'm not even Muslim, but I can pray a couple times a day.
Sure.
This carpet's beautiful.
Beautiful carpets. No, I'll
walk in a really tiny hallway.
Listen, I walk in sometimes into these rug stores, they have the most beautiful, like, huge, and I'm like, how much? And they're like, $50,000. I'm like, first of all, like, why do you even have that up? Like, who's buying that? Okay? And secondly, what I'm saying, is it $50,000? Or are you just throwing some number at me? Like, if I really had the $50,000 to buy that rug right now, could I get it for $20,000? Like, is it that far? How much are you making off this rug? And I have a friend who actually used to work at a rug store. He finally told me, he's like, some of these rugs, because of the history, there's a story, you know, there's thread counts, there's,
right.
You know.
You ever seen those Afghanistan rugs where they actually, they weave in tales of war and they'll have like tanks on them and like AK-47s?
I've never seen those.
They're
but
beautiful.
But
I mean, that's their history of the last, 100 years, so it's made its way into the carpets because all the carpets tell a story.
Exactly, and that's what happened with the Moroccan rugs that we bought. The guy was like, you see that eye? The eye signifies, like, he goes, this was whatever, the bride had been sent away, so she had, and then part of you is like, is this guy making this shit up? You know what
I'm saying? Why couldn't they draw a comic book? Why do they have to weave it into
Look,
a comic
then what happens is every time people come to your house, that's a cool rug. Oh, let me tell you about that. This is a warrior who had the, oh my God. But what were you saying about buying the house? This happened, because right now we're experiencing some heavy rains. We bought our first house, I think it was October of 2004, and it like hadn't rained for a long time. And literally, we close on the house. And the next night, we're sleeping. And it starts raining. And we're sleeping, and it's raining. And I'm like, oh, this is a beautiful sound. And I'm like, wow, that rain sounds really close. And I look over, and like, there's a leak in the roof. It's leaking. And I'm like, what the hell? And the thing is, when you go through buying a house, you go through the inspection process. And what had happened was we got a lot of it inspected. But when it came time to inspect the roof, you go, you can spend another couple $100. A guy comes and inspects it. Or my buddy had some guy who was working on his roof. I go, can he just come and take a look? So I guess the guy came and looked. He's like, all right, it's good. So then it leaks. So
see, that's the problem with getting a buddy to do it.
It's horrible. With a buddy, the guy was working for my buddy. But the guy, once we called him, we're like, dude, you said it's all good. He's like, bro, I was doing you a favor for your buddy.
Right.
Get lost. And it was exactly that. So then I had to find a roofer who comes over and he's like, it's going to be whatever, $5,000 to fix the roof. I'm like, oh.
Right. That's why comedians shouldn't be trusted with these decisions.
Oh, God.
So you've been all over the Middle East because of the Access of Evil tour, right?
Mm-hmm. What happened
was... at the height of the war, how much, like, because, it's interesting, like, as a white person, sometimes I'll be around, like, white bigots or racist people, and they'll let some like kind of racial slur fly because they'll think, hey, you're white, I'm
sure,
white.
Sure.
So I mean, like, travel around the Middle East during the height of the war, you must heard all kinds of interesting insights.
Yeah, I don't hate you, but I hate those fucking Americans. It's interesting because we went out in 2007. What happened was when the special came out, it did really well on, went on Comedy Central, went on YouTube. And then we started getting calls from the Middle East. And I've told the story before about how if you would have asked me when the special came out, where will you be performing a year from now outside America, I would have said England, Canada, Australia, all the English-speaking countries. I honestly had forgotten that the people in the Middle East spoke English. I didn't even know that many did. And then like a few months later, we get a call from some guys out of Jordan who are like, we would like for you to come to the show. And I'm like, I'd love to, bro, but it's in English. And the guy's like, yeah, I'm speaking English to you right now, you idiot. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's a good point, And it's funny because then we went out, we did 5 countries, and it was like, it was me, Ahmed Ahmed, and Aaron Cater, and we went out, and I felt like the closest thing I ever felt to the Beatles. Because what happened was, the special, there was a guy out there named Jamil Abu Warde, who's a Palestinian guy who lives in Dubai. He helped us sell the special to a cable network out there. So it aired in all these countries. Tickets went on sale. The press was into it. We'd have press conferences where there'd be a bunch of press and ask questions. It was pretty crazy. And it was great. Everywhere we went, press was there. tickets were like we went to like Lebanon, for example, and the Lebanese promoters had found there's a venue there called the Casino du Liban. It's a casino, 1,000-seater, and the promoter said, he goes, we bought one night, you know, we wanted to do one night with you guys. He goes, it's sold out. So we added second night, sold out. Wow. Third night, so we sold 5 nights. Like, he didn't anticipate that. So a lot of these places like really just took off. And what was interesting was, for the most part, people of the Middle East love American culture and American people. And the thing that people would let slip, it was just obvious. It was like just their dislike of the Bush administration, distrust of the Bush administration. You would hear that all the time. I mean, the one thing that once in a while you get into a conversation is somebody might, you know, if someone's a little more radical, they might bring up like the Zionist plan of, you know, of Hollywood and blah, blah, blah. And then you have to get in an argument with these people about, yes, there's a lot of Jews in Hollywood, but at the same time...
But the gays really run it.
The gays.
And that I don't know what you heard about Jews running show, but yeah. It's the gays.
Yeah. That's who you want to hate. But that's what I'm saying is, like, you would have to explain... Like, one of my problems with anyone who has a conspiracy theory about anybody at all is you go, well, that takes the control, that takes power away from you by believing in a conspiracy theory, which is, you know, then you're saying, okay, well, it's all because, like, a lot of Iranians are big on that. You know, everything that's happened to Iran is because of America and Israel and everybody else. And I go, well, what about our own lack of organizational skills?
Right.
You know, what about the fact that...
Choosing some bad leaders.
Some bad leaders.
Gotta be a little bit of it.
Yeah, nobody paying your taxes. Doesn't that hurt? You know, yeah. So, you know, it's this kind of...
Have you been to Tehran as an adult, as a comedian? Did you get to perform there?
When I was a comedian, I went out there. So I was born there. I was there until I was 6. And then when I was in my early 20s, about 15, 16 years ago, right when I just started doing stand-up, my father had moved back to Iran because he came to America with a lot of money, lost a lot of it in bad investments, and after, you know, 10, 12 years of being here, went back to Iran to try and do some stuff with his properties there. So he ended up staying there the rest of his life. So I went back to visit. Like I said, I was there for like 2 weeks. And it was interesting. What was interesting to me was I hadn't been there in about 20 years when I went. And the first thing that was interesting was I would walk into some of my relatives' homes and I would smell a smell I hadn't smelled in 20 years. And instantly I was back. It's amazing, the sense of smell. I was like, Oh my God, this is from my childhood. And the love I got from my relatives was beautiful. But it was also depressing for a few reasons. One was... you feel the government and the society kind of oppressing people. You feel it, especially when you come from America, where people walk around the streets in like skinny shorts and, you know, boobs hanging out. Nobody cares. And then over there, you're worried about walking down the street with my sister, we're both fully clothed, but somebody, if they choose to, could come up and be like, hey, what's going on? You guys married or what's the deal? You're not supposed to be hanging out together. So there was that. But the other thing I realized was there's a cultural difference in that in America, like when you turn 18, you know, your parents go, get the hell out of here, go do something. Whereas in the Iranian culture, in a lot of cultures, they want the kid to stay home till the kid gets married. And it was interesting. I had a cousin there, this girl who was a really good artist. I remember she's showing us her drawings, and she was like maybe 13 or 14. And I go, wow, you're talented. Like, is there anything you can do with this? And she goes, yeah, I'd like to. I don't know. Maybe my mom, her mother lived in Switzerland, and her dad was in Iran, or my uncle. And then as we're talking, her father called her, and she goes, her name was Sarbanoz. She goes, Sarbanoz, bring some tea. And I realized that's the culture. It's like we have the bring the tea culture, which is, you know, serve your elders, listen to your elders, do what they tell you to do, as opposed to going, oh, wow, you're talented, kid. Get the hell out of here. You know, like in the movie Cinema Paradiso, where the blind guy tells him, go, don't ever come back. Isn't that a great film?
It's one of my favorite films of all time.
Yeah. It's an amazing film. And that's what I think.
If you come back, I won't see you.
Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful. But that was a little depressing to me to see that. And the other thing that was even more depressing was, no matter what you say and do, there's a lot less opportunity in Iran than there is here. And that's another thing I say is I really think people, like, I think high school kids should be forced to go live in other countries for a year.
Yeah.
To see what they have.
Yeah.
Because over there, every young person I ran into would be like, hey man, can you help me get a visa and move out? You know, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, this poor guy doesn't even speak English that well. If he came to America, he'd be driving a cab. and, you know, away from his family. And here he's got no opportunity. So it was a little depressing for those 2 weeks. But I haven't I've not gone back since, because I think that I'm better known now, and I'm afraid that if I were to go back,
they'd be Elvis Presley there.
I'd be Elvis. Jesus, I'd be Elvis Presley, but I'd be in prison probably. Like, they
really?
I think the government would.
You don't think you're seen as like a real positive Iranian American to these
people? I think that the people, yes. I think that the government, especially like during Ahmadinejad and during all that stuff, like there were some jokes I did where I was poking fun of the leadership. There was in the 2009.
There are no gay people in Iran.
There are no gay people. Which,
can you not make fun of that?
Yeah, I mean, come on.
And then he had that, remember before Happy Days, before Fonzie wore the leather jacket, like the first season of Happy Days, he wore this like beige jacket.
Yeah, the members
that's
only.
That was the same coat.
Yeah.
He was first season Fonzie.
That's so funny, man. I didn't even think of that. That's funny. That's funny. He was. He was first season. Maybe that was what inspired him. But no, but it was like, you know, you do some jokes and then you don't know how they look. It's almost like they're looking for an excuse to mess with a lot of people. Because I've heard of Iranian scholars and stuff that are, you know, in America, but they go back to visit their old parents, elderly parents, and they'll throw them in prison and say, you're a spy. You know, I hosted, there was a human rights rally. And when the 2009 election happened, where the Green Movement, the uprising happened, and people were protesting everywhere, and I hosted one of these, you know, human rights events. So all I need to do is go there, and they might pull it up and be like, what's this? You know, I mean, there was a journalist, this guy's name is Maziar Bahari. He's a Canadian journalist who's been on The Daily Show a few times. And as a matter of fact, Jon Stewart just directed a movie based on this guy's book. And this guy tells a story of being there covering the Green Movement, and then they came and they got him. They go, you're a spy. He worked for Newsweek. You're a spy. And one of the pieces of evidence they showed to show that he's a spy, he had done, because he'd been on The Daily Show before, The Daily Show had sent Jason Jones to cover the elections from a, you know, comedic standpoint. So Jason Jones shows up in one of those brown vests and like a keffiyeh, like he looks like he's on an adventure. And he's going around just reporting Daily Show style and just saying stupid stuff. So at one point he's interviewing some guy in a cafe and he's asking him stupid questions. And he's got Maziar Bahari, the real journalist, sitting next to him being the translator. And so Bahari's just translating for Jason Jones. And supposedly what happened was when they got Bahari and they were showing the evidence against him in front of him, they showed that clip. And they go, who's that? And Bahari's like, oh, that's Jason Jones from The Daily Show. I'm like, no, that guy's a spy. And they go, no, he's a comedian. And he goes, no, you're translating for a spy. So it's, they're that whacked in their minds and that paranoid. And so I don't even want to mess with that. I don't need to one-way ticket. I'm not into that.
Wow. I heard on NPR there was a guy, and you're from the Bay Area, so maybe you know who it is. It was like, the guy's supposed to be like the Iranian Bob Dylan, and he lives in Oakland now.
Yeah. That was, I think you're talking about Arash Sobhani, maybe. There was a band named Kiosk, and the guy kind of sang, his voice is very similar to Mark Knopfler's. And it's they sing rock. Maybe that's him, or maybe someone else.
He was a rock guy, and he was supposed to be like the Bob Dylan of...
That's guy. It's either
he was saying, I could never go back because I would be tried as a spy.
Yeah, he criticizes the regime a lot. And there's a handful of artists that once they come out, they don't go back because of whatever reason, whether it's criticizing. I mean, I've seen like... There was a great movie that came out a couple years ago, won the Best Foreign Picture. It's called A Separation. If you haven't seen it, you guys should see it. It's an amazing movie. And the director's name, Asghar Farhadi, he's out of Iran, and the movie was great. And you know, in the movies, these actresses have to cover their hair. You know, they're not in like a burqa, but they just have almost a scarf covering their heads. And this one lady who was in that, was a great actress, I ran into her in DC one time after a show I'd done, and I was at this restaurant, and she was all dolled up and ready to go for the night in DC. And there were some people there that wanted to take pictures of her. And she's like, oh, no, don't take a picture of
her. Because she didn't have a headscarf.
She didn't have a headscarf. And that ends up online. She's going to get in trouble. It's like, are you kidding me?
Wow.
You know, what are we, in kindergarten? You know, it's like, move on. You know, it's just stupid.
It was interesting how upset the Iranian government got at the movie Argo.
Yeah, Argo is
because if you're gonna have constant rhetoric against the United States, you gotta expect to look like a jackass in their films.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is, what's interesting?
They were kind of clownish, like the buffoonery.
Yeah, and what it is it's funny. First of all, that goes along the lines of that philosophy that hey, the West and Hollywood has it out for us, and they're always depicting us negatively, which when you look at it, you go, you know what? You kind of make a point.
They do have a point. Right. Yeah. They're selling this goofy, they're making a science fiction movie at the height of the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Well, that supposedly was true, if I'm not mistaken. Because I didn't want to audition for it. And this is like, I run into this a lot where I go, you know, I don't want
to
do
it. Or you asked to audition for it.
Just asked to audition. But that doesn't mean they offered me the part. They just wanted me to audition. And I didn't want to audition for it because of what you just said, which is, all the Iranians in that movie were depicted mostly negatively. There was one guy who my friend played, actually. I don't know if you remember the scene when they go into the bazaar, and he's kind of their handler, and he's like, hey, you guys are making a movie. Is it a love story? And the guy's like, no, it's a science fiction. He's like, oh, and he's kind of upset about it because he wanted a love story. And then they start walking into the bazaar, and they start taking pictures, and the next you know, the bazaaris go crazy on them. And here's my argument is I say, when you show an image like that, people that are watching it, whether subconsciously or whatever, you think, oh, wow, look, they're all animals. Like I told you, they're all crazy and animals. But if you go down to Venice Beach and take a picture of some of these homeless guys,
they go apeshit.
They go apeshit.
Yeah.
And if you show that in Venice Beach, people watching it go, oh, that's one crazy American at Venice Beach.
Right.
Whereas when you see the Iranians doing it, you're like, oh, they're all like that. So that was my problem with it. And I was saying, like, throughout the movie, I'm thinking to myself, this guy came into Iran, and there was the maid, who was actually, again, a friend of mine, this actress who kind of helps out at the end by not ratting on those people staying at the embassy. But I said, you know, this guy came into Iran, and there had to be somebody who, an Iranian, who maybe had worked for the previous administration, or someone who had said, hey, here's your papers, here's the ID you'll need to get around, good luck. You know, blah, blah, blah. At least show that guy for a second, you know. But then again, I also go, look, man, it's a movie from a point of view. So, you know, I've just made a movie right now. And sometimes you go, I don't have time to get into this storyline. I just need to tell my story and get out and keep it entertaining. So I kind of see both sides. And that goes back into what I said, which is like, I'm not going to sit here and bitch about it and be like, conspiracy theorists, you know, I'm smarter than they are and they can't pull one over on me and then not do anything about it. So, you know, then I turn around and do my own movie, which is a comedy with an Iranian, it's like a Persian Pink Panther.
This is the movie you're writing and making now.
Yeah, we just shot it last October and we're editing it now. And it's called Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero. And it's basically, it's a silly comedy.
Iranian Pink Panther.
Iranian Pink Panther, that's what it is. That's it. Right
you're going to have the assistant who jumps out in the taxi with all
you
times.
Know what, we thought about that a few times. It didn't quite work out that way. It actually ended up, you know, I don't know if you ever have you ever produced an actual movie?
I've tried to make a documentary.
Dude, I mean, it is a lot of work. Jesus. And getting the script together, there were so many times we're like, oh, what about what you just said? What about a guy who pops out and, you know, let's just emulate the Kato character? And we're like, nah, you know, and then there's like a girl who was supposed to be his love interest. And then we're like, we don't know. So there's so much that we had to do. And finally, I think we ended up with something going through the edits right now that is pretty funny. It's funny. It's entertaining. The only reason it could be considered groundbreaking at all is because, in my opinion, I always say it's like the first time we're gonna have like an Iranian lead who is a comedic lead, and it's not he's not a terrorist. He's none of that stuff. But it's got funny, silly stuff in there. And we made the best movie we could, and I'm proud of it. I'm proud of what we did, and I'm telling you, man, it feels like, I was saying, it's almost like you're, especially because we produced, I co-wrote it, and starred in it, and I produced it. And I said, like, producing a film is like saying, okay, I'm going to build a skyscraper. And then you go, okay, well, go ahead, design it. And you're like, oh, I got to design it? Okay. They design it.
Well, I'm not going to use the guy who advised me on my roof.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's step one. Note to self. Yeah. But then as you go along, you go, okay, then you design, then you go, then they go, okay, well, what color do you want to paint it? And you're like, oh, I didn't think about that. They go, well, yeah, we go, fine, let's go red. And then they go, okay, well, what painter do you want to use? You're like, okay, now I got to meet with 10 painters. So basically, all along the way, you're constantly involved in it. And it's so much, sometimes when I hear people talk, like, we'll get on the phone and talk to people about, like, how are you going to distribute it? That just, sometimes my mind starts to just explode.
But you put so much energy just to get the thing done.
Yeah.
That part of the game plan.
Well, also because that's the part, I understand the creative part. I understand getting, you know, let's come up with the best funny that we can. But then once you get into like, okay, what about the sound mix? What about the color correction? What about the
final print?
Yeah, the score. Who's going to score it? I'm like, I don't know. And then you watch the score. I mean, I was talking about this just recently because we just did a screening. It was a little too long. There's no real score under it. And then I go, well, the score is going to, it's amazing how much score helps a
music,
scene.
Yeah.
And I go, look, think about it. I go, if Darth Vader were walking out without music, he'd just be some weird dude in a black outfit. But as soon as he gets dun, 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 you're like, oh, shit, this guy's badass. You know what I'm saying? It's so true.
So what happens with the movie now? Is it a release date? Or you go to film festivals now?
Yeah, so now what we're doing is we're finishing the editing and all that stuff, color correction, all that stuff's going to come together. We're going to do a couple more screenings because really the audience, the core audience is probably like teenage boys and girls like up to 25. It's a silly slapstick comedy. So we did a test screening where we had like 3 or 4 teenagers and the rest were like 40-year-olds. So like, okay, it went pretty well. But we go, we really got to get in front of the audience that we need to get. And now here's another problem. You got an independent film. You can go spend $10,000, literally it's $10,000, to get a company to organize a screening of 50 people for you.
Wow.
Or we've been doing this. You can call up different people that you know who teach in schools and go, hey, is it cool if we come and screen this at your school? So we're trying to do that. And then there's a couple of moments where, you know, there's an F word. There's a couple of raunchy moments. And you're like, well, the principal might not let it in their school. So we're figuring that out. So we're going to finish that, lock the picture, and then really it's about, it's a different world, man. It's about, I think I would love to do a couple of big festivals if we can get in. Comedies always have a harder time with festivals, as you know, than like, you know, these dramatic kind of quirky films. And then the other thing is, I was just talking to the director about this, was he was saying how he was at a seminar with some independent filmmakers who were saying, look, the world we live in right now, we can't compete with some of these studio films. Like I remember reading about this Kevin Hart film that just came out, about last night, and it was on Deadline. It said the movie cost $12 million, and then they spent another like $30 million promoting it. So I'm thinking to myself, wow, that's, where am I going to get $30 million? I mean, our film was shot for $500,000. Like, where am I going to get this money? So the options are plenty, and we got to visit it. If there's a distributor that loves it and goes, we'll put some money behind it, great. I would love for this to be in movie theaters and do well and go from there. But if not, then there's a lot of options. One idea that somebody had given me was, they said, I guess Margaret Cho does this. I don't know this, but when she shoots a special, she tours with it and like does some stand-up and then shows the special and like charges whatever, I don't know, $50 a ticket to come see this.
Hmm.
So if you go do this around the country and you hit like 20, 30 places, and if you sell like 1,000 seats, you're making 50,000 each time you're going. Obviously there's some costs, but hey, why not start the game with, before you even sell it to HBO or Showtime or Cinemax, where are we gonna sell it to? Why not start the game with a little bit of money? So we're trying to figure it out, man.
Well, you're a pretty established actor. You've done a lot of big acting roles in movies and television. I would think maybe that course would be a little easier for you, but I guess it's not.
It's not, you know, because it's like, that's what I was saying. Like before doing a movie just as an actor, I was saying it was crazy. I would show up.
You can't call up your friends in Qatar or the King of Jordan.
Yeah, you would hope, right?
Remember how much you loved me as a comedian?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is like, I mean, everybody promises you the world when they see, oh, you're doing this, you're doing that. And then once it comes down to it, a lot of people pull out. Now, whether it's because they don't like the content or they can't be associated with it or they just really go, I mean, look, businessmen in the end, there's a reason why the guy's rich, because he's made his money in roofing or whatever it is. I actually had a guy who was like, this guy was like, I'm the biggest roofer on all the East Coast. And he wanted me to pay for the movie. Like he wanted to invest in my movie. And then we met. And then he just disappeared. And I think part of it is because that's how he makes his money. And he knows movies are a major gamble. So he probably was like, you know what? I just keep making my money. I'll go see his movie when it comes out. I spent $10 or whatever to see the film, you know?
Right.
But the difference...
I almost produced that.
I almost produced that, right? And then hopefully it's a hit, and then people, and then he can go, oh, I should have produced that. But, you know, that's rare. I mean, who knows? But the thing is, the difference between acting in a movie and producing a movie is like when I was an actor, oh, what's my call time? Great. You go through hair and makeup? Yep. Okay. We'll let you know we're ready for you. And now I'm in my trailer. I'm napping, making phone calls, checking emails.
Yeah.
And they go, come to your lines. I do my lines. That's a wrap for Maz. All right, great. I'm home. When you're producing it, oh, my God. Like, first of all, I was in almost every scene. We did a 3-week shoot, 18 days, you know, 12-hour to 14-hour days of days every day. And then even if I wasn't in the scene because I produced it and co-wrote it, I'm hanging out and watching it. So it was just like I ran on fumes for 3 weeks, just constantly going and going and going. And it was exhilarating, you know. But and that's the thing, man. That's the other thing I was saying. I was like, I have so much respect for filmmakers right now. People, some of these filmmakers have spent 10 years writing, rewriting, producing, doing this, doing that, losing their family, mortgaging their home, blah, 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 get the movie out. And the critic goes, this sucks.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm taking a bat.
I'm going to go find this son of a bitch.
You know? It's crazy, man.
Yeah, how could you not be so passionate about it?
It's crazy.
You've acted with some pretty, you know, huge heavyweights and... In the film industry, you were in a movie with Sean Penn.
Well, that's what, it's funny, man. When you watch somebody like Daniel Day-Lewis, you're like, what the hell? Like, that guy goes so deep. I have no idea how he does it. And for me, the moment was, if you watch Gangs of New York, where he is just this guy from early 1900s New York, does every part of it. And I don't know what those guys were like, but I'm buying that that's the guy. And then Cameron Diaz, who, you know, was great in, like, Something About Mary, but she's in there. And there's moments in that movie where I'm like, she just lost her accent. And I go, oh, it just came back. And just going in and out. You know? And I assume if I did it, I'd be closer to the Cameron Diaz school of acting, where I'd be like, oh, one scene I got it. But it's amazing, these guys, when they go deep like that. And no, it was cool, man. I got a chance to do, you know, be, you know, once in a while you get your scenes with some of these people who are just masters, you know. And it's like, Sean Penn was one of them. What was interesting about Sean Penn was in The Interpreter, that was the movie. It wasn't a movie that, like, it wasn't like... Dead Man Walking or something. It was kind of a, for him, even though it was a suspense thriller, I think he was pretty light in terms of his mood, at least the scenes I was in. And the one thing I realized, though, this is what's interesting is, you know, there's basics that you learn in stand-up or in acting or whatever from the start. And then along the way, I think sometimes you forget to do the basics. And one of those things was like watching Sean Penn, like when he's getting ready to do a scene, he was like going like, okay, so that's, he was kind of figuring out like the setting, like, okay, that's what that's going, like, I saw him talking to, I think it was the director or something, Sidney Pollack, and he's like, you know, that's where that is, and that's where that is, okay, so I'm seeing to myself, oh, he's doing like the like, you know, as an actor, a lot of times you go, what's the moment before I came into this, whereas like nowadays, especially with cell phones and all this crap, I'm, before the scene starts, I'm just like sending an email, and they go, action, and now he's like, you know, now I'm about to kill this guy. Well, what happened before? Like, what happened before was I sent an email. That's what happened before, you know? Whereas you got to remember, like, no, dude. Take a moment and think about it and get into it, you know? So I just watching him do the basics was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that, you know? So that was cool to see that. And then,
what are the best techniques you keep in mind when you're acting?
You know, for me, it's funny, again... Sometimes it's like, it depends on what I'm doing. I love, even though I'm trying to do less accents, I love doing accents. So a lot of times that will actually help me find the character a little bit. I just did a guest star on this TV show, Shameless, where I play a guy who's putting on a fake Sri Lankan accent. And it was actually interesting. It was fun to do. But then what's even more fun is the scenes had Joan Cusack in them, and she's a regular on the show. So at the end of the scene, or maybe sometimes throughout the scene, she would kind of improvise a little bit. And I love that because that really brings you into the moment. If I'm supposed to say, you know, hey, ma'am, here's your coffee. And she says, oh, you know, I ordered a latte. And I go, I'll bring it right back. But if she comes back and goes, I ordered a latte, you know, don't mess it up. That gives me the chance to go, hey, wasn't my fault. You know what I'm saying? Like, now you're in the moment. You're like, hey, don't be so aggressive, you know, and now you're going somewhere with it. So I love that kind of stuff. Early on, one of the the first film I ever did, which was funny because it was a movie called Miriam. It was about this girl in the late 70s. She's living in America, in New York, and she's a young girl, very Americanized. Her parents are Iranian. The hostage situation happens, and her whole world turns upside down. And in that movie, I played like a little bit of a comic relief. I was a family friend who was in college and very much like womanizer or whatever, Persian guy, but in America. And one of the things I told myself, I was like, okay, this is late 70s. This guy is definitely a big fan of Saturday Night Fever and Tony Manero. So what was great was like one of the first scenes when I kind of show up at the house, I was singing in my head. I was like, well, you can't tell by the way I use my
woman.
So that music can really bring you into the place sometimes. And I used to use that a lot more in movies where I would be like, what's the song that's going to bring me to this place? I remember I did another movie where I was like supposed to be this real, it was a short film, and it was supposed to be this very like gut-wrenching, like my wife is acting crazy because she wants to leave me, and me and my mother are very oppressive and we're trying to keep her. But there was like a emotional moment, and I played Simon and Garfunkel's The Boxer, because it always reminds me of my dad when my dad was young, because my dad had grown up in northern Iran, a place called Tabriz, and he'd come to the city Tehran, and that's where he made himself, but he had to like leave his family to go there. And I just, that whole I'm just a poor boy, though my story seldom told. You know, that whole thing. I'm listening to this, and I'm like, oh my, it kind of gets me into the emotional, and then that would take me. So that's another technique that I think is a great technique, which I haven't used as much as I should. You know, I don't know why. I don't know why. I think it's the damn email and the Twitter. I got a tweet. I'm too busy tweeting. Here I am with Joan Cusack.
What have been your most memorable characters or bizarre characters?
Well, for me, what was really fun was that Friday After Next was a great experience because...
Yeah, what were you like? So you were like a Compton ghetto stoner or what?
No, I was... I play Moli, who's a donut shop owner. They had a Middle Eastern character in there. This guy who owns a donut shop, and he owns the strip mall where Ice Cube and Mike Epps work as security guards. And what was fun about that experience was that... And I think I kind of brought this in when I went to audition. They really let you... improvise a lot again, and that all was based off, I think what had happened was probably in the first one Chris Tucker probably did a lot of improv. Second one I think they had Mike Epps do a lot of improv. So the third one,
Puff Puff Pass, motherfucker.
Puff Puff That's, Pass. Yeah.
Hey man.
That's the American way.
Yeah.
Of passing around a joint, which Europeans don't do.
Yeah, they don't
hold
do it.
It and they pontificate.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
Yeah,
that's good to know. Just grab it. No, it's. It was cool, so they would, you know, so because they would have Mike Epps improvise, then we were kind of free to go off of that a little bit. And there was a lot of cool people, like, you know, John Witherspoon was on that. He was really cool about, like, just being loose. And then Cat Williams, it was me, Cat Williams, and Terry Crews. It was all of our first big film. And we were the three new guys, and it was so much fun. And Cat was fun to watch, and he was great, and Terry was great. And it was just this... cool experience, man. And what's interesting is, you know, it was funny when we're filming that, a lot of people were like, man, this is gonna blow you up, this is gonna blow you up. And I was like, I have no idea. And I did 2 weeks on that, and I just left my day job, went into 2 weeks, and then I went back to answering phones somewhere, like, just like, you know.
Wow.
I didn't know what's gonna happen. Then I got like a commercial, and then this, and then I just kept going. But it was interesting to watch Terry and Kat like blow up so much in that community and then blow up beyond that. And for me, like, the film did well, but it wasn't like, it was an interesting film because it's a fun film, but it wasn't a film that did necessarily well in the industry. It wasn't like, you know, like if you do an episode of something like Curb Your Enthusiasm or Girls or something on HBO, the industry sees you. But if you do, you know, Friday, the industry doesn't see you. But you do get recognized walking down the street by every black and Latino guy. So it was beautiful, man. It was a beautiful experience. And to this day, I'll still get people recognizing me from that. And it's pretty funny because the diverse range of people that kind of see me as, you know, bigger than I see myself. One is like the Persians and the Arabs, and the other one's like blacks and Latinos. You know, so it's like the mainstream doesn't quite go as crazy, but like I'll be walking down the street in Beverly Hills. This happened. I was walking down the street, one side of the street, bunch of kids from Beverly Hills High. So it was like 6 or 7 Persians, 1 Korean, 1 white dude. They're all friends. I'm walking down on the phone, suddenly, Mashupai, oh my God, Mashupai, picture. I'm like, whoa, this is great. Walk across the street, no one has any idea who I am. And it was such an interesting contrast. And the same thing will happen, like, I've actually started doing this bit on this. I was riffing with Don Marrero one night. He's like, you should do that as a bit. I go, I always tell the story, but I never did it as a bit. But after September 11th, like, I fit the profile. If you looked at me on paper, I was like 18 to 35, Middle Eastern male. Like, I could have been one of those guys. But
right, when you tell the story about going to the White House and they pull you out of the line, I was thinking, oh shit, he's getting profiled at the White House.
Oh, no, they didn't profile me there, because it was a bunch of Arabs there. They were like, you know, that would have been like a setup, Arabs and Middle Easterners, Iranians. but what happened was, so I would go to the airport and I was a little worried about getting pulled over, but what's interesting is Friday After Next had come out. And so a few times this happened where I was in line, you know, TSA line, and there's black dudes working there. And I would see them and they'd be like, oh shit. And they'd look at the other guy and be like, they'd be like, it's Molly. And then they'd be like, Molly, come on through, Molly. And I'm like, I feel awkward doing this, you know? So it was an interesting thing, man, being recognized like that, and then the other thing, you know?
Beautiful.
Yeah, man.
My wife and I have been obsessed with Italy the last few years, the last 3 years in a row. We've gone to Rome and rented an apartment.
Oh,
and
wow.
We're both also into these great courses, these university courses that you can get, like on audio download or CDs. And, you know, we get them about history and different stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I was listening to one on Roman history before we went to Italy last year. And it was about just the Roman Empire and like Israel at the time of Jesus' execution. The Romans didn't give a shit about that part of the world.
Yeah.
Their biggest problem was what is now Iran.
Yeah.
And the Persians. They're great warriors, cantankerous throughout history.
Yeah.
That needed to be dealt with and negotiated.
Yeah.
And I just used that little knowledge nugget to set up. You speak Italian?
Yeah, I do speak Italian. Well, first of all, it's funny that so the Romans didn't like the Iranians, and now America doesn't like
But throughout history,
powers that
be—they have been getting cantankerous bricks that had to be dealt with.
Yeah, I speak Italian because I was there. I did junior year abroad. What happened was, growing up, you know, I took French in high school. I was kind of not that into it. Went to college, started taking Farsi classes because I speak it fluently, but reading and writing not so well. And then they had a class that was beginners for people that had no knowledge. Then they had a class that was like fifth grade. And they threw me into the fifth grade class. So I had to, like, you know, swim so I wouldn't drown, because I didn't know how to read and write. So I'm teaching myself how to read and write. And I get through the year or the semester, and I thought I made some good progress. But the teacher graded me on the curve of the whole class. And I was like, that's not fair. I go, there's no class for me, and you guys are giving me like a B-. When I realized you get A, like, my progress is pretty damn good. And they're like, well, that's what it is. So I was like, you know what, man? Screw these people. I was like, I'm gonna go check out Italian. And that time I was like obsessed with The Godfather, Goodfellas, all that stuff. And I go in there, I remember getting in that class, and the first moment the teacher goes, come ti chiami, and the language just bounces at me. I'm like, holy shit, what a cool language. And then there was this really hot Argentinian girl who was taking the class, and I was like, beautiful women, this, and we became friends. But it was like, I was like, oh, I'm sticking with this. And I studied for a year and a half, then I went to Italy for a year.
Where did you live then?
I lived in Padova, which right near Venice. And man, I was like, I left there, I was, because I had an Italian girlfriend for the year who didn't speak any English. So my Italian was really good. Like, I was writing papers in Italian, all the classes were in Italian, and it's a shame because I still speak it okay. And if I spend enough time there, I kind of pick it up as I go. But when I left there years ago, this is over 20 years ago now, I honestly was like, oh, I'm going to come back every year, I'm going to do this. And in reality, I've been back like twice. And it really sucks because life just happens and you just, you know.
Well, you got kids, it might be difficult, but I was going to suggest you do like us. Like when I finish a European tour, we'll go to Rome. I'll set it up like just to go there for a week.
That's a great idea, yeah. Man.
You have to reward yourself after 2 months of doing like solid gigs.
Yeah, a little Airbnb nowadays. I think
that's what we do. And there's one, sleepinitaly.com.
Oh,
that's where we found the best apartments in Rome.
I got to check it out.
Yeah.
You know what's funny you say about Rome? Have you driven in Rome?
No, Jesus.
Oh my God. I mean, like, maybe the hardest place ever in the world I've ever driven. Because what happened was, we did one summer, we were with some friends who, they go to Tuscany. So we went and spent a couple weeks in Tuscany. And then like the last night or so, we were going to Rome because that's where we flew out of. So we had to rent a car from the Rome airport. You get hit the freeway, you go to Tuscany. That's easy. On the way back, we're coming back. My wife had to get on a phone call for business. And we literally, the freeway was easy, like 4 hours of freeway, easy. You get off on the freeway, and back then we didn't have, the phones didn't have navigation. It was like, you have to have MapQuest, you know, the printed out MapQuest.
Yeah.
And from the exit to our hotel was, I think, supposed to be like 5 minutes. It took us another hour to find it. We just kept going. We would go, and you would ask people directions, and everyone would be like, yeah, just go straight, and then go right. Diretto, e poi a destra. And you're like, okay, go. And I'd be like, I would take the right. And then I'd be like, what happened? And suddenly be somewhere else. And it was the craziest. It's because what it is, it's such an ancient city. So the streets aren't like in New York, you'd be like, oh, here's the avenues, here's the streets, go. You know, over there was like, and then, you know, Piazza di San Marco, whatever, and then the little, like a little square somewhere that you're supposed to like turn right on. It was the most confusing city to drive in, man.
I drove in Sicily once years ago, and I got really lost. Because, like, you're supposed to go straight, like, the arrow on the street signs are, like, pointing, like, up and to the right.
Yeah.
Which to them means straight.
Yeah.
So, like, I would get off the exit and go, okay, I'm supposed to go this way.
Oh,
so it was really confusing.
Disaster.
Yeah.
It's a disaster. And, yeah, you understand why the places are so unorganized sometimes, these places.
What's the best thing you can teach me in Italian?
Let me see. In Italian, I'm trying to think. There's a few. Like stammi bene means like, you know, stay well. But you say stammi bene. Stammi means for me. Like, I think it's like stay well for me. Like, do me a favor and be, you know, take care of your stuff. Basically, stammi bene. That's like a sign off. STAMMI. Stammi bene. The other one is in bocca al lupo. That means good luck. In bocca al lupo. In the mouth of the wolf. Means good luck. So if someone's like, oh, I'm going to go do, you know, go whatever. I'm going on I got a test. I got to go on a journey or whatever. I'm going on a trip. I'm going on a date. Hey, bocca al lupo. There you go.
The wolf's mouth.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah, you grew up in Marin County, California.
Yeah, man.
One of the most livable, luxurious places on the planet Earth.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty
beautiful.
Crazy.
Beautiful.
It was amazing, man. You know, like I said, my dad owned an electric company in Iran. And so he was a self-made millionaire. So when we first came to America, he had a lot of money. And then we had friends that were living in Marin. And we ended up coming to stay with them for a little bit, settled down there.
What town?
Well, they were in Mill Valley. We ended up in Tiburon. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it was amazing.
Two of the nicest places on the planet Earth.
It's amazing, man.
So you got all these Middle Eastern fans. They think, oh, man, that guy's just like me. No.
No.
You're nothing like
that. No. But what's interesting is it's like a lot, because down here in L.A., there's a lot of Iranians. And growing up, where I was, there was a handful of us. So I didn't realize there was that many Iranians down here. And so I'm lucky. I actually like the fact that I grew up around a lot of American friends. I think it Americanized me more. And I had my exposure to my culture at home. Whereas I know a lot of the Iranian kids that grew up down here, you know how it is. Like, people find people of the same kind and they grow up with them. And then it just...
Right. My dad used to live in Anaheim, which down in Orange County, it's just Persian stores and restaurants, and it's their... massive community.
But you can also become, you know, isolated. And if you decide to just live in your community, then you're not expanding, broadening your horizons a lot. Maybe that's why I ended up with my Indian wife, because to me it wasn't important to marry within the community, you know. But some people, I think, I know people of my age and my generation who's... Basically, the influence is like you have to marry within the generation. I mean, within the culture. And so I don't think like that at all. And to this day, I'll have some people like, what's interesting is I've done more and more stand-up. You'll get people from the older generation showing up. I don't know why. I think they think that I'm going to do jokes in Farsi, which I never have. and then they expect more jokes about the culture, and I'm like, well, my audience is actually mixed. I'm like, if you look out, like, maybe there's like 30% Iranians but 70% other, and it's interesting to me, because my whole point is like, I love a mixed crowd. I think we should open our minds, and, you know, and most of the people get it, but every once in a while I get some people who are like, you know, you could tell, like, either they didn't enjoy it because there wasn't enough jokes about Iranians. And they want me to do an hour about Iranians. And I'm like, I can't do
that. Like, you're going to be the spokesman and your whole act is going to be about this.
Yeah, I can't just do a whole hour of that, you know? Yeah. And I actually love to have, like, different people, because I'll say who's from here, who's from there, and see if I got jokes or see if I can learn something, you know? So, yeah, it was, I think growing up in Northern California helped me have that perspective, you know? Otherwise, I might be just doing, like, just performing at Persian cabarets and that's it, you know?
Okay, so you're an Athletics fan, not a Giants fan.
Yeah, I grew up as an A's fan.
Wow.
Because...
Explain yourself.
Ricky Henderson. Yeah.
The all-time stolen base king.
Yeah, yeah. I just, as a kid, I was a fan of that guy's, and I used to go to the A's games. And now that I'm older, I also, like, root for the Giants and stuff. But I see the first baseball game I went to was a Giants game. I think Willie McCovey was either still playing or just about to retire. I used to be a big baseball fan. I used to collect baseball cards and all that stuff. And it's funny, like, you grow up and you're like, why do I care about these guys? Like, who cares? Especially now, I watch SportsCenter to get the top 10 highlights. But then once they start analyzing a news piece,
yeah,
I'm like, how much are you going to analyze
this thing? Oh, sports talk is like the most boring thing on the planet.
Oh my God. It's crazy. Like, you'll see, like, they'll be, oh, the highlights of such and such game. And then they go, let's go for an in-depth analysis. I'm like, let's not go for an in-depth analysis.
Right, and then they'll talk for like an hour about it. And basically what it all boils down to is if this team does good enough today, they'll win.
Yeah.
But they'll spend an hour getting to it.
Yeah. Do you watch the soccer when you're over there in Europe?
Love soccer, yeah. I actually just went to my first premiership game in London.
Oh, how cool
is that?
We were
just in London for the last 2 weeks.
Who did you guys watch?
I went to see Liverpool at Arsenal.
Oh, wow.
Good friend of mine. The power of Twitter.
Yeah.
Good friend of mine, comedian Chris Martin, who I met doing the New Zealand Comedy Festival with last year. Huge Arsenal fan, wanted me to go. He only had one ticket. He tweeted to his people, American comedian Tom Rhodes wants to go. And somebody tweeted back, and I was in the second row behind the goal.
Oh my God!
It was fantastic.
Now, it's not reserved seating? You ended up sitting separately, or
no? Well, he had his ticket,
right,
that he just bought by himself.
But what I'm saying is, isn't it reserved, or are you going to go stand anywhere together you want?
No. It was reserved. I went with a guy who had season tickets, and he just
the
person he normally takes didn't go that game.
How cool is that?
So I got to go, and I made good friends with this guy.
Who was cool.
Cool banker guy, but it was awesome.
Yeah.
It was great.
I would love to. I've never been to I've never been to a foreign game. I've been to MLS here. I've seen Galaxy.
And stuff, yeah.
And then the team that I went to, I was in Portland doing shows, and my buddy had tickets. And those guys are really serious. Like, the Portland fans, it feels intense.
Seattle, the Northwest are our best soccer fans.
Yeah.
We went... with Drew Carey to the Sounders. He owns the Seattle Sounders.
Oh, wow, okay.
And we got this like 2 years ago. And we got to sit in the owner's box with
Drew. Cool.
And there's like, you know, they got like shrimp cocktails drinks and waiter.
Yeah.
And then it was some cup. And the Sounders won it. And then we got to go on the field and take pictures with Drew and the trophy.
Oh, that's cool.
It was
man.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
Living in Holland, I went to see the Dutch national team play Spain Rotterdam.
Oh, wow.
And that's when I started digging. I went to a few Amsterdam Ajax games.
Yeah.
So that's when I started to get into it. And then my mother's from Buenos Aires.
Oh, wow.
And I've gone there to visit cousins.
Oh, yeah.
And it was going to River Plate matches is what made me really love football, because I went to a match that ended in a riot.
Oh, wow.
They set the stadium on fire.
Oh, my God.
And then riot police came in with tear gas. They tear gassed the other side of the stadium. And then they were beating people with their batons. It was the greatest day of my life.
Oh, my God.
I've been to 1,000 baseball games. Nobody ever set the stadium
on
fire.
That's hilarious, dude.
It was great.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm thrilled that the United States is getting more into football.
Yeah.
And World Cup countries. Yeah. Playing each other is my favorite.
Yeah, no, it's fun, man. What's good about watching that is at least you know it's going to be an hour and a half and that's it, you know, and you can watch it. And obviously you want a good game. And sometimes, as you know, if it's even a low-scoring game, that builds that tension. I mean, all it is it's almost like ejaculating, because it's like you wait, and then like 90th minute, the team scores. You're like, oh! You know, like, oh, that was good.
I've been working so hard.
what a game. Let's have a smoke. You know, it's true though, right? It kind of is. It builds that pressure the whole time. You know, it's totally what it is, man. Oh my God.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, wow. Man.
And so where did you start doing stand-up comedy in San Francisco?
In L.A., man. I was a big fan of Eddie Murphy since I was a kid. I was 12 years old. I wanted to be like him. I was like, I want to be like even younger than him getting on Saturday Night Live. But I had no plan. I had no idea what to do. I was doing plays. My high school had a really good theater department. I was doing plays. My high school teacher was like, hey, you could do this professionally. She's like, you got the talent for it. But actually, she was like, you got the talent for it. But you got to do something about that nose. I was like, thanks. But my parents, like, you know, being immigrant parents and being Iranians, they only knew, like, lawyer, doctor, that kind of thing. So they're like, you should be a lawyer. So I remember actually, my sister actually and I went to Cal together, and she was doing some project, and she has a tape of me being like 18 or 19. And she's like, what do you want to do with your future? And I go, I was thinking about doing an acting thing, but I really don't know what to do with that. So I am going to listen, you know, I go, but my mom and dad convinced me that I should be a lawyer, so I think I'm going to do that. So they actually had, like, convinced me of that. So then I ended up doing undergrad poli sci. Oh, here's my wife and kids.
Oh, good. Undergrad some background poli-sci. Noise. We're almost
done. Yeah. Anyway, long story short, I just kept dilly-dallying in it until I was, like, my mid-20s. And I was working in an office, and I decided, you know what, I live once, I'm going to go for it. And I ended up taking some stand-up comedy class. I took Judy Carter's comedy class.
Oh, wow.
This was 15 years ago. And it really helped me just kind of figure out what to write about. Because that's the thing, I've always felt comfortable on stage. That was never a problem, because I was doing plays since I was 12. It was like, what do I write about? And it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s, I decided to really go after acting professionally. I started taking improv classes. And while I was there, Judy Carter was taking these classes as well. She's this lady who was a comedian who just started teaching these classes. And what was great about the class was, the stand-up comedy class was, it just showed you, she just broken it down. She goes, every comedian has a point of view. Every comedian is either saying, it sucks when, I'm happy when, it's crazy when. And she goes, fill in the blanks and talk about yourself. And that was it. And it kind of helped. And that kind of got the basics going. Then from there, the biggest boost early on in my career was becoming a regular at the Comedy Store, where I get to perform, like, you know, at midnight in front of 8 drunk people and really learn to let go of my material and start becoming comfortable with who I was on stage, you know?
What's the greatest advice you've ever been given as a comedian?
Best comedy advice is just getting on stage. And that came from that Marin Indian. That's a very good. He was just talking about that.
I'm like, in.
Yeah. No, it really was just getting on stage. It was just early on in that class. They were like, get up as much as you can. And I think that got in my head right off the bat. And then from then on, it became automatic. It's like going to the gym. Like every Monday, I would call the Comedy Store. I would call the Laugh Factory, whatever it was. I was like, hey, put me down for every night. And then as the nights would go, I'd be like, oh no, I got, like, whatever, I got a birthday that night. And I'd be like, oh, I just have to leave the birthday early. And there's many times with Preetha early on in our relationship, we'd be at this party having a great time, and I'd be like, oh, I gotta go, babe. And it felt bad leaving, but it really in the end ended up helping me, you know, get better and be focused, you know.
Cool. Maz, you're a beautiful man. I love watching you on stage, because it always reminds me, enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's all about having fun.
Thanks, man.
In closing, is there any words of wisdom or advice you'd like to give the people of the earth?
People of the earth, just be nice. You know, no reason to be a dick. And if you feel like being a dick, take a walk, come back, and let's revisit this thing. That's it.
Beautiful.
Simple.
All right, Maz. Long may you run, brother.
Thanks, man.
Long may you run.